Welcome to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast. Today, I have a really fun guest to spend some time with. James Francis wrote the book called There's Coffee in the Fridge. Now, if you guys all know me, I have become somewhat of a coffee snob, I think, or a coffee aficionado. So I'm not sure about coffee in the fridge per se, but I think there's a deeper meaning to that. So we're going to dig into that as we go along. But this is one of those life stories that are really fun to listen to. We've all had sort of our moments. You know, if you read my book, you know that I had my moments in time that we had to get beyond. And it's just great to listen to people who've been through the journey. And James, I'm really excited to get you on to talk about your journey through anxiety and depression, starting with what looked like a really good start to life that had a few bumps along the way. And I think maybe you'll help us figure some stuff out. So welcome to the podcast.
Appreciate that. I'm glad to be here, Joe. Thanks.
So, James, you know, I think that the context is always good to start. Maybe where'd you grow up? Like, what was it like being a kid? You know, I think you were a D1 player in lacrosse. So you had, you know, some really big things going on, and you became executive at some point. And so a lot of good things happened. But then, so let's hear the backstory before we get into what happened after that.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I appreciate that. I think that's part of the reason why I wrote the book, is because the backstory, right? All of our backstories is ultimately the root cause, or where you want to find the issues if you're looking to fix something. And so yeah, I grew up on Long Island, which is actually where I find myself today, stuck in a hotel room in a pouring rainstorm because my 40th high school reunion is tonight. So yeah, so it's an interesting sort of confluence of people that are coming into my life today. But yeah, I grew up on Long Island. I was the only son of my parents. I had three sisters. My parents separated when I was very young, 6, 8 months old. So I grew up with my mom and my three sisters in a very small home, very humble. We never lacked for anything, but we knew we were not wealthy by any means. And, you know, my outlet in life, my full focus in life, the thing that I think helped me survive much of my depression experiences was athletics. I was a great athlete from a very young age, and the time when only one person got a trophy, not everybody got a trophy. I was a kid that got the trophy. So I that parlayed itself into a lacrosse scholarship to play in college. And I played at a pretty serious level of lacrosse until I was about 30 or 30. So it's always been something that's been involved in my life. It's given me very good fortune in terms of, I would say, a stable underpinning to get me through stuff. You know, so I've always been athletic. That's a key part of my health, and it's something that I love. So I got out of college and married my college sweetheart and went to work in Manhattan. You know, I went right to work down on Wall Street in the insurance business, actually, and wanted to reverse my humble upbringings and was focused on making money. And that was literally my focus from the time I graduated from college until I had my breakdown, which I talk about in the book pretty extensively, at about 40 years old.
So, you know, West Coast, East Coast, you know, it sort of probably doesn't matter all that much. But this life that a lot of kids go through, right, the pressure of sort of growing up and fitting in and then playing sports as a way to sort of, you know, both learn and experience and validate ourselves. You know, let's talk just a little bit about, you know, so you said you were a great athlete. So there was probably some good positive feedback happening because of that. But how was that sort of, you know, setting you up as you went along? Was that fulfilling enough for you at that moment? Do you remember what that was like?
I do, actually, now that I've gone back and sort of relived a lot of that. And, you know, you hit the nail on the head, right? It's fulfilling to a certain extent, but it's not fulfilling from an emotional standpoint, right? You get the accolades, the pats on the back. You know, I was a kid, this was the 70s and early 80s. So I was a kid surrounded by, I would say, not positive influences of men that just poured their accolades down on me, right? But it's a pretty empty feeling when you're actually home alone and there's no father figure in your house. My mom suffered from depression, so that sort of energy, you know, was in our home as well. So the minute I stepped off the field or off the court, I felt completely empty and emotionally, just emotionally drained, because I wasn't getting what I really needed, right? Which was some sort of a love experience that was a true emotional connection.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, then especially as a a boy, right, and turning into a man, not a lot of societal sort of support for weakness. You're a tough guy. You're going to be able to take it all. And, you know, neither of us are psychologists or probably therapists. So, but what I do understand is that sometimes we think you grow up faster than you do. Like emotionally, you don't grow up until much later, but we look older, we perform, it's almost an adult level, and we sort of are carrying this burden with us that we don't even know what to do with. I mean, did you feel that? Like that, you know, well, here you are, the only guy in the house trying to play sports and be great at that, and nothing back to help James out.
Yeah, I don't think that I felt it at the time. I do know that I had very confusing feelings because I was sad most of the time. You know, I had experienced some trauma in my life, which I had repressed and didn't really address, which you didn't do at that time anyway. I don't even know if we'll do it today. They don't have the language for it. But you repress that and you just sort of move on and you move through it. And like you said, there's you know, you keep put your head down and keep your arms swinging, right? You got to be tough. There's no crying in baseball or whatever expression you want to use. And I think that that leaves you feeling completely empty. As an individual, it's like, well, for an hour or so on a field, I can feel like, wow, everybody loves me. But then, you know, in the car ride home, it's over. And there isn't an additional connection, a real heart connection after that. And so I knew that implicitly. Like I felt it every day. So that's why I wanted to just get better. I wanted to be the best because I knew that that's where I was going to get all the positive feedback from.
Yeah, it's interesting. This isn't unique in any way, right? As you've probably found, you start writing the book, happens frequently. Do you have any sense as to why we have not evolved to understand that this is happening on a regular basis?
I really don't. I will tell you that I currently coach high school lacrosse. So I coach varsity athletes. You know, these kids are what, 15 to 18. I see a lot of helicopter parenting. I see a lot of parents competing through their kids. And I think that is really the underlying issue. If I had to point to one thing, that would be it, right? If I had a wish for every high school athlete that stepped on a field, it would be that they're there for their own reasons, that they're there to have fun. They're there to socialize. Maybe they don't want to be the best, or maybe they want to be the best, but whatever that is, that person's there to live that out. It's really hard to watch kids show up to practice every day that don't want to be there. Right. And it doesn't happen a lot, but I can always pick two or three kids out every year that just, they just don't want to be there, you know? And then unfortunately you meet the parents and it's not necessarily just the dads. It could be the dad or the mom or both. And you know that that kid is being pushed out into an experience that they really want nothing to do with.
Interesting, because, well, what happens sometimes then is what happens to you as a kid. We repeat it later on, right? So going back.
Always. That is a universal fact.
And so if we know this to be true, then we should be, we're an advanced race, I think. We should actually try and learn by this. So, all right. So you get through, you know, well, of course, you're living with a single parent and you're playing at a nice high level and you're getting this good feedback system. And, you know, now you're going to work and get into the work world. How did you evolve out of being sort of like great feedback as a Division I athlete, and now you're back to sort of a square one out of college and now into the workforce in one of the least friendly environments in New York City environment?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct. It's part of it is leaving the field, right? Leaving the field of glory and now putting on a suit and this costume that is not me. Right. And I know that I'm chasing the money, and that's the reason why I'm putting on this costume and pretending to be somebody that I'm not. And I think that was the underlying issue for me. It was that I was now trying to fulfill this thing that I thought society had defined was the goal, right? Put on a suit, put on a tie, go to work, make $100,000 and you know, everything will work out. Yep. And I think that is where I went sideways. And I did it for a long time and I was smart and I was good at it. But at the same time, I think every single day that you walk down that path, you are separating yourself from who you are. And when you're not who you are, the relationships around you start to fall apart and they just can't exist in a healthy environment. So I think it chipped away. It wasn't something that happened all of a sudden, right? It was a daily thing that sort of chipped away and chipped away. And eventually all of the repressed feelings and any trauma that occurred in early life it comes back. It boomerangs on you at a point in time when you can either handle it or you can't, but there has to be a break point.
Yeah. You know, it's sort of, there's another part to this that I always think about is the, so we have the societal issue, we have ourselves, and then we have biology that's somewhat confusing to mix in too, because the biology of the way the dopamine system would work or any of our other, you know, biochemical and neurotransmitters work, like they're there for a reason, right? You know, dopamine's there as a motivation, serotonin and oxytocin are there for relationships and feeling loved so that we're productive members of society. And so when we're not feeling good, it's actually stuff that's actually happening. And so our reaction to it often is we don't understand why we're feeling that way. Did you find, you know, like, because I think that there's this, and what we tend to do is act out a bit, you know, we'll go to the bar or we'll do something else. And then we start to compound this problem. Did you find that pathway? Was that part of the challenge also, what you were doing with your time?
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah, I was, and I really go into this in the book and to help people understand how we consistently damage ourselves. And so, yeah, I was out 2-3 nights a week, sometimes 4 nights a week, couched it or rationalized it as work responsibility and just drinking as much as I possibly could. And right. and finding other more violent behavior if I could find it. Like I would literally go look for fights. So I was, you know, 25, 26, 28, 30 years old, going out with clients, right, in quotes, drinking myself into oblivion and then trying to figure out a way to harm myself, either to get into a physical altercation with someone or to actually, you know, put myself in a really dangerous situation, like walking down the street in Manhattan, waiting for somebody to jump me. I mean, the depressive episodes that I experienced in that time were really dangerous. And I just really wanted to take myself off the planet. And that was the only way that I thought it would happen.
So yeah, these are always these scary moments where in some sense, it feels like some other system is operating you, right? Mm-hmm. There's, you know, we don't want to be like that, but there's something that you can't resist because there isn't a good reason we could ever justify that behavior, right? None of us. And I'm sure a lot of people knowingly have walked into it, but then don't like it later. As this was happening, how, other than this sort of desperate feeling, what was your sort of awareness of how this was starting to develop in your life? And how did you feel about that?
I really didn't have any conscious awareness. I was not consciously competent about what was going on at all. It, like I said, it's one of those things that just sort of chipped away. Now, I was married and with someone who had known me since I was 20 years old. So she had a pretty good handle that I wasn't in my right mind much of the time, but didn't really understand mental health issues, had no experience with it. And neither of us recognized what was actually going on. So, and the thing is that I was highly functional in my job, right? I was very good at it and I was making more and more money. So something good must have been happening, right? And so that's sort of the confusion, I think, around a lot of this, around a lot of mental health issues, is that people can look and feel like they're normal, right? Whatever that means, right. And still struggling pretty dramatically that behind closed doors. So my wife and I would have conversations. We would do this dance of where things would break down and not go well for a period of time. And then she would say, look, enough is enough. You know, we've got to get this out. We've got to figure out what we're going to do. And for 6-8 months, a year at a time, things might go well. But then ultimately, I would slip back, right? Because I wasn't addressing the root issues.
Were there any other areas where you got some feedback, you know, people, friends, family who were saying, hey, James, you know, yeah, that's a little much. Maybe we should crank it back a little. I'm here to help. Did you find any of that?
Not really. I talked a little bit about my family, the people that were closest to me growing up or people that sort of knew me were also dealing with their own issues, right? So that was an area that wasn't helpful to me. I was purposely, now that I understand it, creating very surface level relationships with anybody that I interacted with, right? I did what I needed to do from a work standpoint, but I never let anybody in beyond that. And I think that, you know, that's part of the whole addictive depressive behavior is you learn how to avoid situations where somebody might be able to say, hey, you might need some help here.
Did you, of course, you had this very positive feedback when you're in college and playing sports. Hey, I'm really good at sports. Now I have this positive feedback in the work environment, which is I'm making money and I'm successful. But underlying it throughout that was this fragile person who was missing something, right? And that was really, that commonality continued. And so at some point, right, that foundation is what breaks, right? It doesn't matter if the systems are giving us good feedback. Is now that you think about it now, did you start to see cracks in that, like that got bigger and bigger and made it harder for you to even be like feeling good about yourself with the positives?
I did. It resulted in sort of massive physical exhaustion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would do what I need to do during the week and meet my responsibilities at work. And then, you know, come the weekend, I was just like a wet dish rag. And that continued for some time. And I think that's where I started to see, yeah, this is really not good. And so I you know, it's hard to go through sort of the timeline, right? It's not linear by any stretch. But when we had our first child, you know, prior to that, our relationship was like frayed to a point of just, this might just not work out. But now you've got children. And when you have children in this situation, it changes the dynamic, right? It changes the decision process, which is the reason why my wife didn't leave me after a number of years. But I think that the physical exhaustion is the thing that I would point to that really was the result of that sort of disconnect between some level of happiness and functionality in the business environment.
Yeah. So something was starting to bubble up to the top here. It was either going to break you or break you, right? One way or the other. Yeah. And so, yeah, let's jump a little bit to sort of when it started to break you in this moment where now I knew I need to do something about this. I can't just let it play out anymore.
Yeah. So we, as I mentioned, we would go through my wife and I would go through periods of time where things would break down and then we would sort of get right the ship a little bit. I did try to go to therapy once or twice in my mid 30s, but it didn't really stick and I didn't get it. And I had made a decision. I was running a business in Connecticut and you know, life was moving right along, right? I tell the story about on May 5th of 2005, I had everything that anybody could ever want from the outside, right? Yeah. Cars, country club membership, owned a business, three children, big house, the whole nine yards. And I was just miserable. I could not feel happy. And I didn't understand why. And then I had made the decision at that point that the people around me would be much better off if I wasn't around. And so I just said, you know, I can't find the feeling of happiness. And so I've just had enough. I've been trying to find this feeling for a long time. It's clearly not going to happen. And so, you know, that I decided the next day to kill myself. And so I woke up in the hospital a few days later after that suicide attempt. But that was when it just broke. It just broke and went in a different direction.
Yeah. Wow. Always hard, right? That, like, how do we get to that place? It's not something that any of us ever anticipate, want, or, you know, and it's this sort of desperate attempt to try and reconcile something that feels irreconcilable. And so, all right, so this happens and now, well, it didn't work. We're happy for that. Now what? What's the next step for James?
It's a great question. So came out of the hospital after, you know, getting on some medication and getting balanced and starting to work on therapy and different understanding of the trauma that was driving my underlying feeling of unhappiness. And I think that's really important. I think that people need to understand it's not a matter of blame and what happened, right? It's really a matter of going in and understanding the energy around that. And that if you don't reconcile that, it will continue to stay with you forever, right? And so people that evolve learn how to establish that sort of connection to that initial pain, and then they can move on. People that don't evolve, that's what they're fighting. And then they don't know it, right? They don't know what they don't know. So I came out of the hospital and we're literally driving home from the hospital. And my wife said, listen, and we live in a very small town. I ran a lacrosse program. I had hundreds of kids waiting for me on the day that I tried to commit suicide to coach a lacrosse clinic. You know, I can't go to the supermarket without running into 15 people I know. So people know that I'm not around, right? It's been a few weeks. So she says, listen, we have a couple of choices as I see it. We can say that you were away on business, which is plausible, or we can just not do anything, or we can say, hey, this is part of who you are. we're going to work through this and let's move on. And so that's ultimately the choice that we made was, you know what? And this is going back, right? This is 2005. People were not talking about mental health issues at that point, but that's exactly what we did. I just said, you know, I was an athlete. I think what I need to do is approach my mental health like I would any sort of an athletic training program and just start with discipline, commitment, consistency, practice. And that's ultimately what I did. And we started to tell people what had happened. And it's interesting, the people that leave your life, right, as a result of something like that, either they can't handle it or they're not interested or whatever. But the people that do come into your life, it's an amazing experience, right? Now, there's people around me that are supportive of what work needs to be done. And that was just, you know, that gift continues today. You know, I work with a bunch of people that have read my book and you know, they're like, yeah, this is great. But they come to me for help. And so when you shift that dynamic and shift that energy, it's amazing what opens up in your relationships.
Yeah, it's so brave. I mean, we are probably listening, thinking of those three choices. The last one I pick is telling everyone the truth. I think I'll stay away from that for the minute because we're so worried. The reason you got into that place was that you didn't feel loved before. Yeah. And then you would think, well, if I say the truth, then I won't be loved again. But we all sort of have this innate wanting to help people. And, you know, actually sometimes through that vulnerability, we can bring people closer to us because they feel it too. And yeah, I think probably the ones, you know, we'd probably be a little bold to say this, James, but the ones who move away from you are the ones suffering the same problem.
Oh yeah.
And really don't want to get too close to it because then they'll have to deal with it themselves. But for the rest of us, you know, empathy is a very big and important part of being human. And so if you show some fragility, then we want to help. And so I'm sure that was helpful. And so as you came back through this, so now you went through this, now people know, now you have this sort of new persona to work through. How did that evolve? Like, how did you feel about yourself? How did you start the repair prior, of course, to writing a book? But how did that start for you?
So I will say that it took some time for me to get to a place where I was comfortable with myself and comfortable with forgiving myself the behavior that I had for so long. And that was a really big deal. But to your point, you know, a lot of people left my life realizing that was, some of them were very toxic. And I'm sure I was very toxic to them, right? So I get that. But I felt amazing. It took, you know, 6-8 months after my hospitalization, and I felt like a weight had been lifted off of me that I had been carrying around since I was, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old. So I felt, and I talk about this often, I felt like I literally stood up, unzipped a costume, and stepped out of it and became this new individual with this whole bright spirit and bright future. And I didn't know where it was going to go, but I knew that whatever I was going to go, I was going to feel in a completely different place. And that's exactly what happened.
So you said that really underlying all this was this trauma that you had to deal with. Then you hit this moment where you try and just wipe the trauma out by leaving the earth. Mm. But now I'm back here. And I got this time period to sort of reconcile that. Did you establish some practices during that period of time that were helping you sort of, you know, get to this good state of feeling different about yourself?
Yes. Well, I would encourage anybody to go to hire a professional for therapy. I do think that talk therapy is a gift and it's critical, right? I have an accountant that handles my taxes. I have a doctor that checks my heart. So I need a therapist that can take me through my mental health issues. And so I was seeing somebody twice a week for a number of years to sort of work through this. The first person that and this is an important part of the story too. The first person I saw took me through about 6 or 8 months, and he took me as far as he could go. And it was not a good fit after that. And I think that's part of the recognition that these muscles evolve and you become stronger, and then the person you're working with might not be the right fit, or you might see them the first time and they might not be the right fit. And that's okay, right? Try on a different pair of shoes and move on. I think that's an important part of the story. But so talk therapy was critical. I had learned a bunch of things both in the hospital and out of the hospital that are on my roadmap to health. Journaling, you know, I write a lot of things down, which is ultimately how the book started. It was a journal. I drink a lot of water, eating well, you know, there's nothing magical or different than what everybody knows needs to be done. And there's a roadmap of 10 things that I follow pretty regularly. And meditation was also one of those things that, and I do meditate every day. It's critically important to basically calm the mind, gain control over your ego, and you know, let your body know that you can calm down, that things can quiet down. You know, we talked earlier, I'm the CEO of a startup health plan. I also run a consulting firm. I'm traveling pretty consistently. And I think the ability to calm down and quiet down is one of the things that I crave, that I have to do. And it can be 30 seconds, it could be 10 minutes. It depends on what's going on in the world, but being able to do that is really important.
Yeah, I like the Stoic philosophers, you know, said, worry about what you can't control. And I think that's what calming down is about separating those two into the things that, you know, really do affect you directly and those that are indirect. And sometimes the ones that we can't control are the ones that bother us the most. But if we can reconcile that, then we have a probably pretty good shot of being stabilized.
I think the other thing that I would mention too is that forgiveness. So living gratitude, right? Being grateful for things and actually writing them down, I think is important. The other thing is forgiveness, being able to forgive the people that wronged you. I already mentioned forgiveness of myself. That took me the longest. But
yeah.
But forgiving the people that had harmed me and letting that go was critical.
Yeah, it wasn't going to help you to carry that anymore, right? You'd carried it.
Exactly. Yeah.
In a very, very deep way. How did your family react through this learning and growing process?
That is a great question. It obviously was a collective experience for everybody, right? My children were still young. They were 12, 10, and 6. Our 6-year-old didn't really know much, really what was going on, but the 10 and the 12-year-old, my daughters both did. They experienced a fair amount of fear as a result of that, right? The person that you look up to that is providing, that is, you know, sort of the rock in the family, has just said, I'm broken, I don't want to be here. So that's a traumatic experience for a kid. Yeah. We took that as part of the healing and also as part of the work that needed to be done. And so, you know, you have to meet people where they are. You're not going to sit down with a 10-year-old and say, hey, your dad tried to kill himself and this is what we're going to do, right? But over time, again, with a professional's assistance, you take them through that process. And so we all went through this process together over the probably following 5 years, where the kids were in some therapy when they could be and they wanted to be. But we generally talked about these things pretty openly. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that some of this is in your DNA, and it is in my DNA, right? Depressive traits are in my family on both sides. Suicide is in my family on both sides. So we know that our kids are walking around with this DNA. So we've given them the tools to address, to feel this and address the issues as well.
Yeah, the thing that's sort of interesting about, especially because it happened to you and then it happens to them, is that sometimes what we do, we don't understand the impact. I'll make it up. Like, you know, James goes on a business trips and his kids are like, well, my dad's not here because he doesn't like me, you know? And that wasn't at all the intention, right? You were going on a business trip, but they don't understand, maybe because of their age or their experience or their need. And I think trying to spend some time in this explaining and taking time to understand how someone feels about that, because maybe they just need that, you know, hey, yeah, I'm here for you. It just, this is work, not anything about you. And I think that taking that time is really important, especially as you go through this. So then when along this journey did you say, hey, it's a good idea that I should write this into a book? How did that happen for you?
Yeah, so about 3 or 4 years into my learning process, I had taken some jobs. I had taken a step back and taken some jobs that were probably lesser than my experience would have wanted, to slow things down. So yeah. I was home. I wasn't traveling. I was basically, you know, I was making lunches for my kids every day and reconnecting with experiences that I had missed for a long time. And I had the benefit of being able to do that. Now, those were conscious decisions, right? We were living pretty leanly. We didn't have a lot of money, but, you know, we were doing what we had to do, or what we wanted to do, I should say. And about 5 years in, I was like, okay, listen, I need to get back to getting serious about my career again. I feel like I've learned enough where I can live this. And I took my first job, corporate, you know, C-suite level position, and said, you know, I've learned all this stuff. I'm going to bring it into the boardroom. I'm going to do meetings with meditation. I'm going to teach people how to journal. I'm going to be who I am, right? In every situation. And it was amazing how that was embraced and how people were craving it, right?
Wow.
Now, I'm not suggesting that you sit in a meeting and you ask people to be vulnerable in a dangerous way, right? But when you open up with stories about your life and other people start to open up freely as they want to, it changes the whole dynamic, right? Your team becomes more creative and more collaborative and all these positive things that result. And I was like, oh man, this is pretty cool. So I was invited to speak to a group of people called the Happiness Club. A guy named Lionel Ketchian started this group 20 years ago in Fairfield in Connecticut. And the Happiness Club now is all over the world. There's chapters everywhere. So somebody who I knew Lionel, and he asked me to come in and tell my story. So I was in a room of 50, 60 people in Connecticut, basically telling the story that's in the book. And people came up to me afterward and said, you've got to write this book. I mean, that is a book, right? And I had all these journals written because I had gone through this catharsis process where I needed to get my stuff out on paper. And I sat down and I said, you know, this could be a book, right? I wanted to teach people what I knew, but I didn't want to preach in any way. Mm-hmm. So the format I've taken is essentially tell my story. And through that story, I think there's a learning, right? What I'm trying to do is get people to think. And once you start that thoughtful process, then you can say, you know what, I'm ready to make some changes and evolve myself.
Right. Yeah. I imagine there's some people who are not ready for a book like you wrote, and then many where it can sort of fit to, you know, what they want to hear and learn and be encouraged by. You know, I was chuckling a little bit about the meeting and, you know, like, well, we're not going to have everyone have to sit in a yoga position. I think that one of the problems sometimes that happens is that there isn't a model. Like someone says, you know, we need to be more vulnerable. Well, that doesn't mean there's only one way to do that. And it doesn't mean that you start off by saying, like, I'm confessing to you. Right. You know, what it just means is like there's a little bit about just being complete, being real, not moving away from both the combination of the good and the difficult. It's the embracing of it, because we all deal with it. And, yeah. You know, I often think of it like Michael Phelps, right? We're very sort of, I think, all benefiting from his acceptance of, you know, the depression he's gone through. This is a guy who won more gold medals than anyone's ever won, best swimmer ever, more world records, all this stuff. The only thing that could happen in his life is he could be slower and not as good. Right. And so that's a reality. It's like, this isn't like, you can't hide from that. And then similarly, it's like, you can't hide from that. Oh, well, maybe, you know, my pet of 15 years passed away, or something happened, or my car got banged up, or I.
Exactly.
Like, just accepting that our lives are more complete than just getting the task done. Yeah. And I think as a leader, whatever role you play, that's what vulnerability is about, is accepting that we're on a journey that doesn't look that different from each other.
I agree 100%. And the thing is, so you have to create boundaries, right? Because you do want people to be safe, but you also don't want them to cross those boundaries. But you also need to make room for whatever it is that they come at you with, right? So people are on varying degrees of vulnerability and openness. But if somebody says to you, hey, you know, my marriage is falling apart and, you know, I'm an alcoholic, you have to be able to accept. They have to make room for that, right? As a leader in the business environment. And so it has to come from the top down. And if it doesn't, it really won't work ultimately. You know, most people are just out there trying to check a box. And that's the difference.
Well, and I think, James, the other one that I often think of is living whose life? Is it yours or someone else's? Mm-hmm. Like, how many times are we doing something really to satisfy someone else versus who we are? I mean, I'm sure people are listening to this who had issues with, say, alcohol, for example, and then, but they don't want to drink anymore. But everyone's like saying, oh, just have a drink, have a drink. You're like, if I want to, I should. If I don't want to, I don't. But sometimes we decide based on, you know, sort of the externality rather than what's inside us. And getting that strength, I'm sure that you worked on that hard for a while. It was like, I want to be James Francis who's living this life. How did you address that? Like, what did you do? And you told people, this is how I'm going to be.
I just am. I just be, right? I be who I am. And look, I work with people right now, business partners and people that I work with very closely that have read my book. Some have gotten all the way through it and it resonated. And some have gotten through page 10 and had to put it down, right? Mm. I draw boundary lines. If I want to go, if people are getting, I was just in Washington, D.C. We just rolled out a new product down there. And it was a bunch of legislators and some lobbyists and the press, and it was a big event. And afterward, you know, everybody was going to dinner. And so I said, yeah, I'll go to dinner. And then after that, everybody went out for drinks. And I said, you know what, I'm going to bed. And so it's just a matter of drawing the lines that you don't want to cross, and knowing that what you will feel the next day as a result of sticking to being who you are is a lot better than anything else that you could possibly feel.
Right.
And it takes practice, right? It takes
I think that the other part of that I found, you know, my story is as similar as is different, you know, I'm sure their podcast would be in the same category, was to sort of establish for everyone else, you know, what mattered to me or what matters to James, so they would respect it for that. Mm-hmm. You know, so my own was, you know, when they would go to the bar, I would say, well, I'm going to go for a run. And they're like, well, no, you should come. I said, well, if you want to come for a run with me, that's good too.
I love it.
And if you don't want to, you don't have to, but it's the same, right? This is the same decision. It's not a choice like yours is a better choice or mine is. It's we're both going to make our choice. And then what happened was with enough consistency, then they would start to say, oh, he's going to go for a run. Like they would then give you the latitude to make your decision. And then right. It became who that was. But there's that point that you got to sort of work right through that challenge. But once you establish yourself, then people do respect it. I did find that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, it's interesting. I've done that as well, where I've said, you know, I'm going to go for a run, or I don't want to play golf for 5 hours. I like to play golf, but I don't want to play golf for 5 hours. Let's play tennis for an hour. Yeah. And it just shifts the dynamic a little bit. And I think at the end of the day, everybody just wants to be seen. And I think that was the thing that was missing for me as a kid, right? As an athlete, you're being seen, but when you come off the field, you're not. And ultimately, I think that's what people want. They just want to be seen. They want to be connected. Mm-hmm. And they're not really sure how to make that happen. And for some people, it's like, yeah, let's go for a drink. But once they realize that ultimately they're not necessarily wanting to go for the drink, they're just trying to get that connection. So right. let's change right. that and let's connect in this way. You know, yeah. let's go for a walk. I was running a company in South Carolina a number of years ago, and we established a meditation room, right? And some people would go and meditate, but we also walked. We, you know, every 3 hours, no reason given. If you want to get up and go for a walk around the building, get up and go for a walk around the building. And it connects people in a way during that walk. Because now they're not working. They're talking about whatever they need to talk about. But again, you got to give people room to make that happen.
Yeah, I like that. So the writing a book, you know, everyone's like, I should write a book. It's never an easy process.
Yeah.
I love the idea of the title. So tell us a little bit about the title.
Yeah, so the title is essentially the magical moments in life. Like the moments that are so important can be so small. And that's the recognition of there's coffee in the fridge. I was getting back to work, getting ready to go on my first business trip since my breakdown. And I was getting up at 4 a.m. and going to go to catch an early flight. And I said to my wife, listen, and she liked to sleep in. So she would get up at 7, 8 o'clock, and I was going to get up at 4. So I said, hey, I'm going to get up early. I made some coffee. It's in the fridge. And I'm going to just grab my coffee and go to the airport. And so she knew I was pretty anxious, and I was nervous because I was jumping back into a life that, you know, had almost right. in the ground. And so I woke up at 4 a.m, I tiptoed around the bed, I leaned over, I gave her a kiss, and she turned to me like with a big smile on her face, wide awake, and said, hey, there's coffee in the fridge. And we both just started laughing, and that was it. I mean, just carried that with me through my entire trip. Wow. Still makes me emotional, but she saw me. She knew what I needed in that moment. So that's the reason for the title.
Well, I'm not sure I expected that either. But that is, that's life right there, right? That is what, you know, I might go on as bold as this, James, and sorry if it's too bold, but that was the moment you were looking for in your life.
100%.
Sometimes it takes an effort to get there, but we can, right? This is the key point. Every one of us is capable of finding the moment when we're to the other side. It might still be a lot of work, right?
Yes.
But we get to the moment where we've dispatched that trauma in that moment, right? It sort of all that effort was going to now be okay.
Yeah. I tell people all the time who are in an unsafe place, right? They're either thinking about suicide or they're concerned that they might go down that path. And I tell them that if somebody had said to me 20 years ago that today could be a day where I'd actually be happy, I might not have believed it, but it would have given me some hope. And that's ultimately where I'm at, right? I, like the happiness that I exist in today was the feeling I was trying to get to 20 years ago, and now right. I have it. I get it, you know, and it's possible. It is possible.
Yeah, it's also beautiful that both she went with you on the journey and others did too, right? To be there
absolutely.
To support you, regardless of, I'm sure, how hard it might have been and how dopey you might have been a few times.
Yep. Yeah, it's a learning experience for everybody. And I think that we both could have walked away just in that one relationship. We both could have walked away and gone our separate lives and lived and done our thing. But having worked through that together has created even deeper, a deeper connection, but also it's fulfilled our life in a way that, you know, we couldn't have imagined.
So you write the book, and how did you feel when you were done writing it?
I felt really positive, like, wow, I had done something that few people get to do, but it just felt really good. Like I said, you know what, this is the story of the work that I've accomplished. And so, yeah, it felt very, very good, felt very positive. And it's still, even now, when somebody reads it and sends me a note and says, hey, your book did blah, 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 I just feel like, okay, you know what? I did this for the right reason.
Yeah. I was told early on, you know, when you write your book or you write anything, you got to write it for yourself first. And then if others read it and benefit, then that's really even icing on the cake here, so to speak.
Yeah, it's true. It's very true.
That's it, though. It's a resource. You know, I think we're probably back to this sort of like a lot of people. We start with very little. And, you know, are we really authors? And is that really in us? But maybe, you know, before we wrap up, we're like, what did you find out that was in you that you never really knew was in you? Of course, as an author who wrote a book. But yeah, what else have you discovered along the way?
That there is a side of me that is a creative that I didn't feed. Right. When I was nurturing my athlete, I wasn't nurturing my creative, which is ultimately who I really am. Like, yep. if I could go back in time, which I have no desire to do, but if I could go back in time, I would have tried to go to Broadway, or I would have become an actor or something like that, because that's really who I was. I was more of a just a sort of heart connected entertainer and a writer. Mm. And, you know, so that's really ultimately what I discovered, that I played this part because I was pursuing an economic means, which isn't a bad thing either. But you also have to have the other side of that, right? You've got to feed the other side of that. And I think knowing who that actually is really important. So that's ultimately what I've learned, is to feed that creative.
Yeah. And then it turns into true purpose that can turn into a legacy of what you leave behind, you know, that has meaning and impact for others.
Yeah, it's true. And the one thing that we've both seen, my wife and I have both seen with our children, is they've pursued things consciously in a way that we never had the opportunity to do. And so to watch them now in their late 20s, early 30s, experience life in a way that we couldn't is amazing. It's really amazing.
It's so cool. Is there another book in the future, James?
I think there is. I've got a couple of stories that I want to tell. I've got some stories that I've already started to write. I'm just not sure where to go yet. I wanted to wait. I wanted to wait and sort of go down the path with this one, because there's also a couple of books inside of this book, but I want to see how this plays out and where it goes before I make the decision about what to do next.
Yeah, it's a big labor as well. You got to be serious about that commitment when you step into it again. You know, when we started this podcast, I called it Chasing Tomorrow, because it was always this sort of lean into the future kind of feeling, you know, let's go chase tomorrow together. And so, you know, for you, what's your chasing tomorrow? What are you leaning into?
Well, right now, I am this business that I've gotten myself connected to. And it actually has been very cathartic, because one of the failings that I felt, you know, when I attempted my suicide, was that I was failing in business. I owned the company, and I felt like, you know, I had imposter syndrome. And there was no way I could have been doing what I was doing. It was never going to be successful. You know, all of these things that I told myself. And so right now, and probably for the next 2 or 3 years, my focus is on making this business a success and working with people and working with in a very close way, a very collaborative way. And so that's my chasing tomorrow right now. The other piece of that is, at some point I will write another book, but we'll see where the world takes me.
Well, James, thanks for being so open, honest, and, you know, vulnerable. Your story is inspiring and encouraging to all of us. Look, we know that this journey has its ups and downs, and the moments are interesting and intriguing. But if we stick with it, you know, we get to a pretty good place, which I think you found yourself to.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I appreciate the work you're doing. It's important. So thank you.
All right. Thanks, James. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks.